Welcome to Passive Income Unlocked, where we unlock the doors to intelligent, hands-off real estate investing. We talk to experts in the space about what they do, how they do it, and most importantly, why they do it. My passion is careful, intelligent investing and closing the investing gap one investor at a time. While money doesn't buy happiness, passive income does have the potential to buy back your time. What would you choose to do with your time if you had enough passive income to live your best life? How would you like to spend your days? What kind of impact would you like to make? I'm here to tell you, dream big. There's no ceiling. It's all possible if you take consistent action towards your goals. It's been said that success is 80% mindset and 20% strategy. So we discuss both. Ready to gain knowledge and take action? Let's dive in. Hey everyone, and welcome back to the show. Today, I'm very excited to introduce our guest for the day, Isaac Bennett. Isaac, thank you so much for coming on.
I'm so thrilled to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, really excited to hear about everything that you're working on. Folks, Isaac is the founder of You Are, a people brand, and he's done a lot of different things in various industries and currently focusing on syndicating and bringing investors into alternative assets. So I'm going to let you start us off, Isaac, please, with just how and why did you get into this space in the first place?
Yeah, kind of an accident, to be honest with you. I had been organizing deals for a long time, real estate primarily, in my own account, doing a bunch of deals, and then eventually decided I wanted to get more aggressive and do larger deals. And so I really just started with multi-member LLC partnerships about 9-10 years ago, and slowly grew it to the point where my wife and I finally decided, like, I've got to stop doing this from 7 to 10 p.m. and it's time to give this my best time. So really just last year, we started syndicating full-time within our brand business.
Okay, interesting. So if I understand correctly, it sounds like when you say you were doing deals on your own, were these like single family homes that you were just buying yourself and renting, or what were they?
Yeah, we did a variety of things. We did plenty of that. We also developed four times in Belize, so kind of high-end resort property. We owned some royalties, music royalties, and otherwise. There's some fun stories there about the things that we'd gotten into. And then a few other things too. So, you know, we kind of ran the gamut of alternative assets and also had mixed in plenty of real estate while we were at it.
Okay. And were you taking on investor capital at that point, or was it just your own?
Yeah, our first partnership would have been in 2013, I think. So about 9 years ago. These are smaller scale deals at the time. And we typically just started with multi-member LLCs and started putting them together one at a time. You know, we've scaled up to where we are now, where we're doing much larger deals.
Okay, very, very cool. So what is it that has you interested in the alternative asset space?
Honestly, it is necessity. Because as we look at a couple of spaces, and we, you know, I have to speak out of both sides of my mouth here, because on one hand, we do place people in multifamily deals, but we're very particular about them. We look at self-storage deals regularly. And I got to tell you, I'm not that excited about the returns, especially in the last few years. It's changed so much. They're so competitive. You can still find good ones, but they're few and far between. Mm-hmm. So I think alternatives offer us something that, you know, some of the more traditional spaces maybe can't. And that's the future cash flows bought at a reasonable rate, because that is the wealth ultimately created. Certainly, you know, a capital gain is nice, but it's a cycle, you know. So we think buying streams of cash flow, durable streams of cash flow as cheaply as possible is still the most durable, long-lasting thing that we can do for investors.
Okay, so just to get it straight, so what do you consider alternative versus non-alternative? Because you were mentioning multifamily and self-storage, which some people would consider alternative.
Yeah, I think it's in the mainstream these days. I would say alternative is anything that isn't mainstream, you know. So I would put multifamily, commercial property, self-storage, industrial. I would say that's all sort of not alternative. And then anything beyond that is, that's a real asset. You know, it might be IP, or it might be a trademark, might be a royalty or something of that nature, but that's more alternative. I would even kind of suggest that international real estate it's a bit alternative. You know, we like things that really narrow the playing field of who can offer them.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. So what are you most excited about today in terms of the alternative asset space as you just defined it? And like,
yeah, it actually changes quite a lot. I think there is still a lot of opportunity in jurisdictions outside of the United States that are that have friendly governments that are strategic to the United States or Great Britain, you know, that will be protected at all costs. So I think there's a ton of opportunity in that space. I think that there is a lot of opportunity in royalties still, whether they're commodity royalties or IP trademark royalties. That's a pretty neat and exciting space to be in. And just in general, I think really thinking about tokenizing larger assets and lowering the bar for opportunity is a really exciting space that nobody really is offering yet.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Interesting. Okay. So when you talk about foreign or places that are outside the US, are you talking about real estate outside the US?
Yeah, traditionally, we're looking for irreplaceable property. You know, we're looking for the types of things where we trust the government, solid jurisdiction, preferably tax advantaged. A really solid plan B is nice. And then we're looking for, you know, irreplaceable pieces of property that really, no matter what happens, are going to have intrinsic value that just can't be replaced.
Okay, very cool. So as far as, you know, tokenization is obviously becoming something that people are talking about in the syndication space, at least with multifamily and self-storage. Where do you see that going?
Where I see it going is that if you are a syndicator and you are not prepared to do that in a large fund, you won't be a syndicator in 10 years. And it might be yeah. more like five. So I think the first people to get there at some scale doing it professionally are going to have a massive advantage over those that don't. So where it's going to be niche at first, there will be a flood of syndicators doing it to the point where LPs will require their syndicators or operators, GPs, to be tokenized purely for the liquidity part. And that's something I think that will happen much faster than you realize. I will tell you, though, that there are so many pitfalls out there. And if you don't do it right and do it with the right platforms, it could be a major, major issue for operators. So tread very carefully in this area.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah. Would you say there, I mean, I know it's probably, like, as you alluded to, it's just going to happen no matter what. Do you think there's any sort of negative consequences for the real estate space in general in terms of the liquidity? I mean, obviously, investors want liquidity, but one of the things, at least in what I'm thinking about, is this real estate moves more slowly because it's not as liquid and therefore it's not as volatile. And so do you see that, like, how do you see that playing into the tokenization of real estate?
That's such a good question because it's absolutely true. One of the best parts about real estate is it's super hard to sell. If you wake up in a bad mood, you can't just go hit the sell button, right?
Yeah.
Or if you go to the emergency room and you need 10 grand tomorrow, you can't just hit sell. And I think that is one of the best advantages of real estate is that it's illiquid. But it, of course, cuts both ways, right? Because it tends to get, you know, you tend to not get a premium on the asset because it is illiquid, right? So that's why REITs trade at such greater valuations to, you know, privately held real estate or, you know, anything else, private placement real estate. So I think that tokenization offers something between the two, which is not a REIT, which is a buy-sell decision with one click. You probably don't even know what the REIT holds from an asset standpoint. To me, this is a little bit more intimate way to provide liquidity, which is you're probably holding assets that people know what they own. So there's more of an attachment to it, but they have that opportunity to liquidate if they need to, or liquidate a portion, which would be advantageous. But I will tell you, your question is so salient because absolutely, as an LP or, you know, even as a fund manager, like the temptation to sell is going to be there every day. And you got to be careful about that.
Yeah, totally. Very, very interesting. Okay. Well, tell me about why you have decided to focus on the sort of investor relations, capital raising part of syndications.
You know, I think it really comes down to recognizing who we are. And I'm really passionate about talking about finance and money and very comfortable doing it. So what we recognize is that syndicating is at least five different businesses in one, and they're all really hard on their own. And we didn't think we could fathomably do all five of them well. There are some operators out there that seem to do it and balance it really well, but holy cow, that's really hard. So we said, what part of this are we best at? And what we found was we were best at explaining deals to people. We were best at doing due diligence and really understanding what a good deal was compared to a bad deal across multiple asset classes. It comes very natural to us. And so we said, you know what? We think managing investors and raising money and doing the due diligence for them is our biggest value add. So let's do nothing but that. It's a little tongue in cheek because I own a bunch of deals and operate a bunch of deals, you know, that are in the past now that we still hold. But we think that this is the best thing we can offer investors of who we are.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, real estate's a team sport, right? Yeah. And even operators that have a great capital, you know, investor relations branch, if they're really good operators, they're going to be able to grow faster than they can raise capital, right? And so if there's a way to partner and have everybody happy at the end of the day, then, you know, anyway, so that's what I do as well. And I think it makes a lot of sense for everybody, really.
I think that's right. And I think that folks like yourself, you know, what we can do is we can also help investors avoid a lot of pitfalls, because operators, you know, they fall in love with deals really fast, a lot of them. Mm-hmm. And we can help bring an emotional detachment to the situation where we're basically saying, this is what we're looking for. And if it doesn't work or doesn't pencil, or if there's hair on it, like, pass. And we can pass on things without the expense having already baked into it, or the emotional attachment maybe sometimes to it before getting into it. And I think that's a huge value add for investors.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. Like, having some detachment from it is important, because, you know, so much about convincing or not convincing, but like selling a deal or presenting a deal is how much you believe in it, right? And you can, if you're really in love with the deal, you can really believe in it, right?
Yeah, we can tell ourselves some beautiful lies, can't we? Yeah, absolutely right. And for guys like us, like, you know, at least 19 or 20, and 19 out of 20 of the deals that come into my inbox are an immediate no for some reason or another. You know, so then that 5 out of 100 that we're looking at, we'll choose one maybe of those. And that allows us to just be incredibly picky about what we're choosing.
Yeah, for sure. That's something I'm curious about. So for you, what would you say are reasons that you typically are passing on deals?
I see a lot of structuring that depends on cyclicality. And that would be the first thing. Anything that looks like it's structured based on a cycle that we've seen. And this is making an assumption that an operator has passed all of our hurdles, which is a pretty serious process. We don't have to go into everything that we look at there, but an operator has to have already checked themselves off as someone that we will work with before we'll consider deals from them. So that's a pretty big first hurdle.
Right.
And then you start getting into things like, what's the unlevered yield on cost and some finer mathematics that we want to look for. What are the demographic trends in the city? Are they underwriting? Where are they underwriting on a scale of 1 to 10 from a conservative to liberal standpoint on this? And we want operators in general that are almost ridiculously conservative in their underwriting, because one of the things that they need to do is consistently outperform the performance they put in front of investors previously. So we're probably looking at 40 to 50 criterion just on the deal side individually. And typically, you know, we see 4 or 5 red flags almost immediately and throw it out. So we're also...
Even from operators who've already crossed your hurdle.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's definitely operators out there that we really like, great people that, you know, honestly, to be honest with you, most of the time they're going to make money on these deals. But oftentimes there is a risk factor that we just view ourselves as fiduciaries for people that we are not willing to put them in front of them. There needs to be almost no scenario outside of some sort of disaster that will cause investors to lose money for us to put them in these deals. Do we maybe miss out on some upside on some because of it? Yeah, maybe. But we also take the rule number one, don't lose money, very seriously.
This show is sponsored by Lux Capital Investment Group. Lux Capital provides pre-vetted, highly favorable investment opportunities on a risk-adjusted basis. Our opportunities are diversified across asset classes, geographies, and operators. We are nothing short of rigorous in our approach to evaluating investments. We focus on downside protection, conservative underwriting, recession-resistant asset classes, and forging strong relationships with operating partners and investors. If you want to be an intelligent, hands-off investor and gain access to the types of deals that I like to invest in personally, make sure to go to lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, and sign up for our newsletter. Yeah, for sure. And so what kinds of deals are you looking at these days if you're not looking at like the typical, you know, mainstream multifamily self-storage, like, or are those included? And do you do some of those?
Yeah, we definitely do, actually. I mean, I just think they're harder to find, and I don't think they're where people are looking. You know, I think buying multifamily in Scottsdale right now is probably going to work. I just don't know it's going to. You know, buying something in Miami at a 3 cap, like, these guys are probably going to make money. I have no idea, though, if they're going to. So what we're looking for is cities that are growing in a similar fashion that are being ignored by investors. And I'll give you an example right now where I'm actually not sure if we're supposed to talk about individual deals here or not, but I'll just...
Oh, no, that's... As long as it's okay for you, it's fine here.
Yeah. I'll just be pretty generic. I mean, right now we have a big 772 unit deal that's in three boring cities in the Midwest on paper.
772 total.
Seven properties, 772 units. Okay. On paper, it looks boring, but these cities are growing between 3.7%, 4% per year. Mm-hmm. That's population. Very close to what Austin is growing at, and yet nobody has any idea. You know, so we're paying like low 60s per door. They all have value add, and they're all probably $200 to $300 per unit below rent. So there's, you know, we think that there's $40 or $50 million of value to be improved on these properties. And honestly, the deal works if there's zero improvement.
Yeah.
It's fine. It's down the fairway if there's not. And if the improvement is there that we think can be had in value add, you know, there's a remarkable amount of upside on this. And this is a very low levered deal, unlevered deal and cost strong. So, you know, it's types like that in the multifamily space that we view as something of a unicorn, where we see very little chance of even a cyclical downturn or crash causing our investors to lose money. So we want these types of things where like really bad stuff can happen and they're still made whole with some, you know, some yield. So that would be one example of what we're looking for there.
Yeah. Sometimes like the boring cities are where there's like such little competition, right? Whereas Austin is like, everyone's looking at Austin and competitive to get deals. So finding those sweet spots seems like a really good strategy.
Yeah, definitely. We also love things like if we can get built-in equity through something like historic tax credits. Mm-hmm. We love deals like that where maybe an investor is not putting their own money on the line. They're just putting, it's a balance sheet deal or something of that nature. Very different, much more complex, but we're in the middle of one of those deals right now. It's a 98 unit deal that involves about $8.5 million of built-in equity through tax credits. So that's another example of something we've been putting together that I think is fun.
Okay, cool. And for the listeners who just aren't familiar with how that works, like how is that built-in equity?
Well, you've got, this is very painful, so I'll try to spare them the details. But in some of these areas, you have both state level and historic level tax credits, and they both operate differently. But for qualified expenditures, we're going to recognize about 45% built-in tax credits between the two of them, of which we can then sell those credits to a corporate investor that can utilize, you know, $10 million in tax credits. I can't, but that can utilize $10 million in tax credits. And they're actually going to give us about 82 cents on the dollar for those that they're going to recognize. And in some areas, it's much higher. Sometimes you can recognize 90 or 95%. But it's built-in equity because the investor actually, the tax credit investor actually brings in that equity up front, and then they recognize it on the back end through a tax credit as we recognize them from the state and the feds. So it's a little bit of a complicated mechanism, and I do not recommend anybody going through it themselves without an HTC advisor. But if you can be very careful and do your due diligence and get through this process, it is an amazing way to build tremendous equity into projects without taking as much risk.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Okay, awesome. And we've been talking somewhat about alternative investments and whatnot. And I know we mentioned, like, we talked a little bit about it, but why would you say that people should really be taking a look at some of these less traditional, more alternative asset classes?
Well, I just think that, you know, there's cyclically, there's something happening here where people are chasing yield and they're chasing it as easily as they can, right? And this is true both in paper markets, which have become disastrously expensive, and there's so much reckoning to happen there. And that's not, you know, that's not an unusual take. Nobody's going to be surprised to hear that. But there could be an incredibly cyclical drawdown in the S&P 500. I believe it'll be 60 to 70%. Okay, so that means that people start chasing yield, and they're trying to get into it in the easiest way possible. And they just tend to look at multifamily and self-storage first. And there's a lot of great opportunity still out there in those areas. But I think that there are other things that have a much more durable yield that you just don't have to pay nearly as much for. And ultimately, wealth is the future stream of cash flows that are provided. It's not capital gains. And I prefer to pay less for my future streams of cash flow than some of these multifamily facilities will offer.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So when you're talking about operators that you're looking for, can you just give me some more ideas about what kinds of businesses they're operating? Like if they're not operating multifamily or self-storage, or do you could put like historic tax credits in that category?
Yes. So a historic tax credit deal combines several different virtues probably that you have to get right to make it happen. And it's probably not for every operator. But I think where this starts to get interesting is when you start to find asset classes that don't have superstar operators, or if there are, there's very few and far between. Things like trademark ownership, royalty plays, even commodity royalties, land banking, carbon credits, you know, I'm sure there's some others that I'm not thinking of right now. Resort property ownership, that can be a very different thing. Airbnb, you know, a lot of these other spaces, RV parks. RV parks is one that I have a lot of interest in that we're going to be hitting really hard this year to find ultra high quality operators. And I got to tell you, I'm sure there's some probably even listening, but there's not very many out there. So if you start thinking about the explosion in RV interest and what a wonderful operator in RV parks could do with the right investor base, it's pretty exciting. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, cool. And what is it that excites you about RV parks? Like the experience that they create for people who are vacationing, or what are you thinking there?
I'm thinking it's a really similar play to mobile home parks, with the exception of not everybody and their brother's already in it, you know? Mm-hmm. And you see an industry which is exploding, RVs in general, that I don't think is going away. I think that this has a long track record, a long path ahead of its go. And then you start looking around at the properties that RV parks, and it's super mom and pop. And that's cool. That's great. You know, some of these places are awesome, but a lot of them are not. A lot of them are run down. They're not offering the types of amenities people would want, the facilities people would want. And then you look at the operator space, and there's almost no organized, you know, collective of GPs out there, operators that are doing it. And I think that there is opportunity for people who have an eagle eye here to really have an amazing business in this space over the next 5-10 years. I think it's where mobile home parks were maybe 15 years ago, 10-15 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very cool. Definitely have been, you know, I host a daily podcast, so talk to a fair number of people. And it does seem like there is a lot of kind of brewing excitement for RV parks.
And interesting. Really?
Yeah. I mean, not a lot, but like the people who are excited about it are really excited about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then hearing it a little bit more, you know. So yeah, that is, I mean, and it's obviously a more fragmented industry. And, you know, like you said, like it's where mobile home parks were, because now mobile home parks are not as alternative as they were before.
Yeah, no, I think if you own a mobile home park, you know that, because you're getting like 30 calls a day from people trying to buy it from you. So yeah.
Yeah, totally. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you for sharing so much. I'm kind of curious about, I'm not familiar with some of these other classes that you've, asset class that you met, like carbon markets, trademark and royalties. Maybe you could just pick one of them and tell me a little bit about it.
Yeah. So we'll take, you know, like trademarks, royalties. So we own a couple of portfolios of music royalties. Basically, every time somebody gets on YouTube and plays, one example of what we own is like Will Smith's daughter, her song Whip My Hair, which was, you know, a platinum song when I was probably in like eighth grade or something. You know, so that's an example that's always fun. If it comes on at a wedding, we can say, hey, we're getting paid. You know, so people talk about passive income, and I can tell you that most income that they call passive is the opposite. It's not passive at all. But we love this business because it is truly passive. And with something like that, that has worldwide exposure, you're able to collect mailbox money just for owning the rights to it. And this is true of brands, trademarks, sometimes patent royalties, stuff like that. And so we think that there's a huge opportunity there to buy streams of cash flow for, you know, 3, 4, 5, 6 times the cash flow. And it's basically all free cash flow rather than what other assets are trading at, which is 15, 20, 25, 30 times free cash flow. You know, and you start paying a 3 cap for multifamily. That is a very not passive business that people are paying 30 times earnings for, which I think is insane. So we like the idea that there's very little management, very little can go wrong with them, and they're pretty durable in nature. So there's a whole underwriting thing that has to go on there to happen, but there's certainly opportunity.
Yeah, for sure. Interesting. And so I'm sure there's a lot to this, but how did you pick like that song, for example? So do you own that song?
Yeah.
Is that the right
portion of it? Okay. And the way these things are apportioned is there's several different ownership rights, right? You've got producer's rights, you've got artist rights, you've got usually studio rights and things of that nature. So we own the producer's rights to it. How did we pick that song? I don't know. I've owned it for a long time. I'm not sure I can remember why. But first of all, it's instantly recognizable. I think anybody that was, you know, is roughly my age knows the song. Anybody who has kids loves the song. It's super annoying, so nobody can forget it. But no, we just thought it, like, it had a lot of durability and a lot of reach. And obviously, Will, you know, Will Smith's pretty well known. So, you know, and that came along in a package of other rights as well. So I don't know. We thought it was a premium asset.
Okay. Just because I don't exactly understand how this works. So if it's played at a wedding, what if that person, the DJ, owned like a CD, then how are you getting paid? Because they already own the CD. I mean, I know they don't use CDs anymore, but...
Yeah, they don't use CDs is the answer to that. So really, and this is something that I observed maybe 10 years ago, is that the music industry had pretty much died with a couple of things. One, Napster being one of them, and you know, people burning CDs. That's a salient question. But then all of a sudden I started recognizing, well, nobody's going to use CDs anymore. And Napster, nobody's going to use Napster anymore either because it wrecked all of our computers, right? And so it became apparent very quickly that legitimate revenue streams were going to be recreated through, you know, the Spotify's, Pandora's, YouTube's of the world. And that's why we started buying them, is because we recognized that it was going to be legitimate all of a sudden again. And so the answer to your question is nobody really does it. It's all played digitally, and there's always a record of that digital, and it always goes back, and they're all collected and distributed and paid. And so that industry in general is completely legitimate now, where even 10 years ago it wasn't. So it did create an opportunity, and they've gotten more expensive now because I think a lot of people recognize it, but really nobody does it the way you suggest anymore. So
yeah, for sure. Very interesting. Okay. Well, thanks for going over that. And yeah, just learned a lot from you today, Isaac, and really appreciate you sharing with the listeners. Yeah. Would you please share with everyone how they can learn more about you and anything else you want to share?
Yeah, absolutely. Our website is apeoplebrand.com. And if you're interested in syndication, just click the investors button and reach out to us. That'd be fine. You can also reach out to me on my email, Isaac, I-S-A-A-C at apeoplebrand.com. I'll respond immediately. And I'm happy to provide my phone number in the show notes or something if somebody wants to text or call me as well.
Awesome. Well, I hope you all take some time to reach out to Isaac and see what he's got going on. Thanks so much, Isaac, for coming on the show and sharing all about, you know, everything that you're working on. Really appreciate it. And we'll see you next time.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for listening to Passive Income Unlocked. Before you go on to continue with your amazing day, please take a moment to reflect on what you truly desire in life. Then think about one thing you can do to push the ball forward in that direction. Also, please head over to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts and leave an honest rating and review of this show. It really would mean so much to me. Passive Income Unlocked is brought to you by Lux Capital. Lux works with investors nationwide to invest in real estate. We are closing the investing gap one investor at a time. Connect online at www.lux-cap.com, LUXE-CAP.com, for tons of free educational content to further your success.